This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. You know it's Friday, and you know that means we have our week in review, but we're going to do that a little later in the hour, because right now we have Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley on the line. Congresswoman Pressley just won re-election to the 7th District and will be a standard bearer for a progressive agenda in the next U.S. Congress. This is our first chance to talk with her about how she's preparing for January 2021. Congresswoman Pressley, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Always good to be with you, Tiziana.
So I want to start by congratulating you on a second term.
Thank you.
You are welcome. And so here we are. We are headed into a Thanksgiving when people can't be together, Congresswoman. We've got these chaotic machinations around the presidential election. Daily virus case numbers are setting records. You know, you're a congresswoman, a family woman, a citizen, a member of our greater Boston community. What is weighing most prominently on your mind right now?
Well, I think I can say I'm like most people in the country right now that are holding simultaneous space for multiple feelings and emotions. You know, first and foremost, I'm feeling encouraged and grateful to this movement of the most marginalized, Black, Brown, Indigenous, AAPI, disabled young people who came together and mobilized. And this movement met the moment, resulting in the victory for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. And also the significance of our having elected the first female vice president, first vice president to graduate from an historically Black college or university, to be an immigrant, to be a Black woman, to be an AAPI woman. At the same time, holding space for the fact that 73 million people voted to cling to an administration that has operated with great callousness and corruption and has many failures that have created a tsunami of hurt, a confluence of challenges in this pandemic, the economic hardship and trauma that it has wrought against the backdrop of a national reckoning on racial injustice. And in Donald Trump, we have someone who has contempt for working families and the American people, and who has emboldened white supremacy. And so what I'm squarely focused on right now is just beginning the work of advancing a comprehensive relief package that mitigates the hurt that people are feeling with unprecedented food insecurity, unemployment, many on the precipice of eviction, and then ensuring an equitable economic recovery and a response to this pandemic. And I know we'll have that with this current administration.
There are several themes in that answer you just gave that I want to pick up on. And I think the first place I'll pick up is the movement. You talked about the movement of people who created this moment, the most marginalized people. One of the things that's coming out of the election is a real conversation about who bears the standard for the Democratic Party and for Congress, Democrats in Congress going forward. I know you are well aware of this tension. There are debates going on among elected officials and elected members of the House about whether, in fact, the House lost seats to the progressive messages and agenda items of the younger and new members of Congress, or whether it was the failure to take advantage of the political savvy and energy of the younger, newer, more progressive members of Congress that led to that loss. You are a member of that newer group. You are seen as one of the progressive standard bearers. How do you walk forward with all of your colleagues in the House and find a strategy, an agenda, an approach together that keeps the Democratic Party powerful in this next Congress?
You know, the 117th congressional class has been in Washington all this week for freshman orientation. And I'm reminded of the best advice that I received at freshman orientation as a member of the 116th Congress. And that is that in the process of legislating and governing, it is very easy to forget the plot. But we must never forget the plot, and that is the people. And so what I will continue to center are the people. And, You know, I do believe ultimately, since history is written by the winners, it is undeniable who delivered this victory. It is also undeniable that many of those who are a part of this movement are motivated by issue-based activism, ranging from healthcare to racial injustice to the climate crisis. And so, again, the movement of the most marginalized has met the moment. Democracy is breathing another day. We are turning the page on this dark chapter in our history because of them. And so now we must advance policies that meet the scale and scope of our current crises, ensure an equitable recovery and public health response, but don't reset to where we started, Tiziana. That's very important. This is a time for recovery and, I believe, reconstruction. We cannot return to that status quo normal because it was insufficient, unjust, and inadequate to begin with. And that is why we see people being responsive to policies that previously they may have marginalized. These are not, they're radical in that they get to the root of systemic challenges. And so we have to be bold because we have to advance policies that are as systemic and as deep as the hurt that has been caused by policy violence and negligence for decades. I mean, what is the point of having a Congress that is the first pro-choice majority Congress in the history of Congress, that is the most diverse representative body in the history of Congress, that has an unprecedented number of women serving, if we don't legislate like it? To me...
So, but I want to ask you something about that before you go on.
Sure.
I hear your point. I also recognize that depending on how Georgia goes in January with those two Senate seats, you could be looking at having to work on legislation with a U.S. Senate that has a very different policy agenda and has power on what makes it to the president's desk, even as that president-elect is Joe Biden. How do you practically move forward in a way that gets legislation passed and signed? How are you thinking about the strategic approach to that with a Republican Senate, should there be one in place?
Well, first, I'm ceding no ground, and I'm doing everything in my power. Georgia is a state that I have spent a fair amount of time in throughout my time in electoral politics, and I'm in regular communication with the community-based organizations those camps on a daily basis, and doing everything I can to ensure that we do regain control of the Senate. I do believe that that is within our reach. And it is about continuing to build upon the organizing foundation made possible by many Black and Brown organizers. The story of Georgia is not of this cycle. It's a story that's been being written for the last decade because of people like Nakima Williams and Stacey Abrams and Dashika Ruffin and Tracy Lewis and others. And so I'm doing everything in my power to build upon that. We've already been fundraising for both of those races. Now, as to your more pragmatic question about the mechanics of things, you know, I don't define the things that I advocate for as progressive. I define them solely as bold and responsive to the needs of the people. If others would like to then categorize those things as progressive, that's fine. I do want to make progress, so that is true. But I think the ultimate persuasion tool here is continuing to uplift the stories of those that are experiencing this disproportionate hurt. We did see some gains in relief packages. There was a bipartisan package we did pass early on in the House that included things that previously were non-starters. Like paid family leave. You know, for example, there's a national debate right now about student debt cancellation. That is an issue that previously was considered a non-starter. And you see the Biden administration had a plan for it, and they're talking about that now. There's a national debate on that. Why? Because this administration was garnishing the wages and benefits of people who were defaulting on student loans in the midst of a pandemic. We have to jumpstart this economy. We have to get, you know, relief to people. We have to get money in the pockets of people. And so canceling student debt is just one such way to get at that. Paid family leave, there's nothing radical about people being able to stay home if they're sick in the middle of a pandemic or to care for loved ones in the middle of a pandemic. And so things that were previously more marginalized, the pandemic has laid bare these inequities and has really, I believe, proven that we are going to have to move boldly. What I will be fighting for in a relief package is that our immigrant neighbors are not excluded from relief, that we cancel rent and mortgages, that we have eviction and foreclosure moratoriums, that we cancel student debt, that we have reoccurring cash payments, you know, immediately. It is just the failure of this GOP-led Senate is just, it's unconscionable that they have turned their backs on the American people.
In our limited time, I want to bring our attention back to the Commonwealth, because you coordinated a letter today to House Speaker Robert DeLeo, Senate President Karen Spilka, also Secretary of the Commonwealth Bill Galvin. This letter urges them to address concerns that were raised by a coalition of Black legislative staffers called the Black Staffers of Beacon Block. One of the things that they pushed for in the summer was passage of a police reform bill, which the Boston Globe is essentially declaring today in its newspaper DOA. What's missed in the moment if that thing doesn't pass, especially given that the majority of the congressional delegation sent this letter today to our own statehouse?
You know, I'm
Congresswoman.
Yes, I'm here. Sorry. I'm sorry. I just I was that was a pregnant pause because I was shaking my head with frustration and disappointment that could be the case. You know, again, against the backdrop of this national reckoning on racial injustice and, you know, many people who are quick to retweet and to hashtag Black Lives Matter. But the only thing that matters in this moment are policies and budgets. Those are the only receipts that matter. And so if there's an unwillingness to move on those things, you can really only define it as a lack of political will and courage and not being responsive to the moment. And the generations of hurt that have been supported by the brutality that we have seen play out in front of us in these consecutive months, but for generations, it is, and that's why, you know, I can't stop. I understand the heart of your line of questioning here, Tiziana. And the answer for me is always just that I don't have the luxury of being apathetic or cynical. Even when the landscape is sobering, I've promised my district, I promised the woman that raised me, that I was always going to fight. You know, I'm not going to stop seeking justice. I'm not going to stop seeking equity. I do believe another world is possible. And I'm going to continue to lead as a policymaker and as an activist. Because every time we've been able to advance transformative change in this country, it has come from movements. That is how we have advanced the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, Medicare. That is the result of movements. The power of the people has always been greater than the people in power. And that's not ever going to change. And I'm not going to stop organizing. I'm not going to stop fighting. I'm not going to stop legislating, and I will not stop amplifying the voices of the people. I'm centering them in everything.
That is Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, who represents Massachusetts' 7th District. Congresswoman, I wish you happy Thanksgiving, and I thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Now it is time for our Friday Week in Review, and our lives continue to play out at this intersection of politics and the coronavirus. And as events on both fronts unfolded this week, it felt like we were asking, so what's the message? Join our panelists to try to answer that question and analyze this week's news. We have Wilnelia Rivera, who is a Democratic strategist, founder of Rivera Consulting, and was chief strategist for Representative Pressley's successful 2018 congressional campaign. We also have Joe Battenfeld, who is a political columnist at the Boston Herald. Wilnelia and Joe, welcome to both of you.
Thanks, Tiziana.
Thank you for having us.
So I think it makes sense to start with reactions to what we heard from the Congresswoman. And Wilnelia, since you helped put her there, let's start with you.
I mean, if anything, Congressman Presley is centered on exactly what the priorities need to be right now, which is to reframe the debate. And even though, as you said, you know, we find ourselves at the intersection of politics and coronavirus and what continues to be an unstable transfer of power at the federal level, we need to keep our eyes on the prize. And even though right now we're still having a very much polarized debate in this country and in the Commonwealth about what is the right way forward, I think what folks like Congresswoman Presley are doing is focusing on the fact that at the end of the day, the process of policymaking is bringing people together. And we actually need to be able to reframe this conversation to start doing the work. And the journey between now and January 21st is going to be a long one for all of us.
Joe, how about you? What were your reactions?
Well, I think it's interesting. It illustrates the split in the party, the Democratic Party, I believe. She accused them of the Democratic lawmakers on Beacon Hill of a lack of political courage, specifically, you know, on policing reform and other issues. And they have take that policing reform issue. They don't seem to be able to come together with an agreement on that, even though the governor has put out a plan. You know, other lawmakers have put out their own plans. There's plenty of plans up there to choose from, but they. I think she probably is accurate that there is a lack of courage to deal with this issue. A lot of those lawmakers are getting money from police unions. They don't want to offend them. So there's a lot at play there. But I think she's right about that.
Well, and let's stay with Beacon Hill. And listeners, join this conversation, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Are you watching as the House and Senate have dealt with the budget here in Massachusetts over the last 2 weeks? What do you think about the fact that police reform is stalled after versions of the bill were passed in both chambers this summer? Join that conversation. So I want to talk about the budget bill. And mm-hmm. I want to talk about the Roe Act amendment. So let me backtrack. So we have two chambers, working on a $46 billion budget to submit to Governor Baker. It was delayed in their deliberations. Usually that is signed by like July 1st. They delayed it because of uncertainty around really what the numbers were going to look like in the spring due to the coronavirus. I guess I'll start actually by asking, did we get a better budget by waiting? Wilnelia.
I mean, I think we got the same budget we would have otherwise, which is we got level funding, which is another way of saying we basically funded everything the same way we did last year, which practically actually means it's actually not enough to keep up with the pace of either just straight inflation or the scale of the problem that coronavirus has actually created throughout our entire economy and also in our education finance. You know, it just doesn't stop. So, and one of the things Massachusetts has done well in the past is actually make the kind of investments that are needed either from the rainy day fund or from actual raising revenues. And I know that that's not a very popular thing to be talking about, but if there isn't political courage for the police reform bill, even with proposals that have been put out there, I think the lack of courage on the budget is even greater. At the end of the day, the budget is our values as a Commonwealth. And to say that we can spend today exactly what we did last year with the face of what our municipalities and families are going to be facing in these next couple of months, it puts the hope in that hopefully, you know, as the federal government comes together, that things will get better. And I am of that sentiment as well. But we need to put a down payment today to make sure that we come out of this recovery so that we can actually have a long term conversation about what does it mean to invest in the parts of this Commonwealth that haven't been in that way and that now are even further behind because of the reality of COVID.
So, Joe, over those 2 weeks between the Massachusetts House and Senate, there were over almost 1,200 amendments that got considered to this budget bill. The ones that really stood out were the ones that had to do with bringing elements of the Roe Act into law, which essentially further codified abortion rights here in the Commonwealth. Will Governor Baker sign? You know, he can exercise discretion. What do you think he's going to do on that?
I believe it's likely that he will sign it. He expressed an unhappiness with the way it came about. He didn't take a position on the actual bill, but he just basically said it didn't really belong in the budget, which is a good point on his part. I mean, why are we getting 1,100 amendments to the budget, many of them which have nothing to do with the budget at all? So I think that's a valid question. But I think, you know, it would be interesting to see how Baker reacts, because it might tell a lot whether he's seeking a third term or not. I don't think he can come across as being anti-choice and reject this bill. if he's running for a third term. I think it would be a little risky on his part. So interesting to see what he does.
So I want to ask, will we now likely see other codifications into state law more clearly? The types of rights that a progressive Massachusetts might be concerned will be threatened now that the U.S. Supreme Court has three new quote-unquote originalist judges sitting there, you know, gay marriage, healthcare rights, et cetera, will Nelia?
Well, I mean, I think that the moment, what people, what folks on the ground in the legislature were able to do with the Roe Act is create the possibility for that. And I agree with Joe that I don't, you know, we will be paying attention to whether or not, you know, the governor signs that, but I don't see him not signing that, right? But I think what, you know, I really want to just make this point that I think it's more important for listeners, which is, you know, at a time when we have, you know, such a crisis happening, you know, throughout our Commonwealth, the kind of reckoning that the legislature should be involved in is just more of the same theater that they've done for years, right? You take a stand on one issue, right? And you say that this is the one thing that we're going to do. You tie it with the budget process so that it kind of muddles the water for everybody. But in the end, everybody shows up as a hero, you know, both, you know, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. And I think the important thing for everyone to remember is that we're still both chambers are still a super Democratic majority and have become even more Democratic after this last cycle. And I think when we continue to see Democrats in the House and in the Senate kick the can down the road, that's part of the problem. We just can't take strong stands on one thing every couple of years. That's part of the reason why we find ourselves in the problem that we do now in terms of the need for more revenues and deeper investments that are impacting a lot of real folks.
Let's go to the phones, 1-800-423-8255 to add your voice to our Week in Review. We've got Dave on the line from West Roxbury. Dave, what's on your mind?
Hey, guys. I don't understand why anyone's surprised by this. I mean, we just reelected this legislature almost unanimously. I think the only guy who lost was a Republican guy who had an issue outside of politics. So why are we surprised by this? This is what we wanted. This is who we voted for.
What do you mean when you say this is what we wanted, Dave?
Well, don't we vote the legislature? We have a representative elective democracy. We elect representatives to represent us in the legislature. They do our will. Apparently our will is not to do anything about police reform or raise the budget or raise revenue. This is ultimately what we wanted. I think if you ask most people and they were being honest, they would say, yeah, that's right. That's what
Thank
we want.
Thank you, Dave. And Joe, that I think Dave's call actually builds on what we were just hearing from Wilnelia before we went to that call. Mm-hmm. You and Wilnelia, Joe, both talked about a lack of political courage. You know, we're going to talk about the state parties now. The Republican state party has been even further marginalized. The Democratic state party has such firm hold. Is there need to be uncomfortable as a state legislator?
Is there a need to be uncomfortable? Yes. I think there, you know, to the caller's point, I think there actually is a will among voters to do something about a lot of these issues. I don't think they want just stagnation and doing nothing on Beacon Hill. I do think they want them to act. And on the Republican side of things, I think there's going to be a big reckoning coming up. We talked about this, you know, you mentioned this, but over the state committee, the direction of the party, how it's going, whether they reelect the chairman, who is a strong Trump supporter, or go with somebody different. I think Baker obviously wants somebody different in there. So I think it's going to be a real interesting standoff coming up. And, you know, the Republicans basically in the legislature have zero power at all. They have even less power than they had before.
So there is a moment of reckoning that seems necessary for the state GOP. I want to play some sound from you from Tom Mountain, who is vice president in the committee and was speaking to WBUR earlier this week with a pretty clear-eyed view of what happened to Republicans in the Commonwealth in this election. Here he is.
We got completely clobbered. We were decimated. It was terrible. We didn't pick up a single congressional seat. We lost in the Senate. Every state committee member who ran for something from Congress to county commissioner lost. It was a complete debacle. You can't get around it.
Okay, may have said Vice President there. I think we've all got Vice President Biden on our minds this week as well. Winnelia, they lost five more seats. Jim Lyons, who will now be challenged by Representative, State Representative Sean Dooley for the head of the state GOP, has gone all in with President Trump and really squared off against Governor Charlie Baker, who's one of the most popular governors in the country. You know, as a strategist, what advice would you give to the Republican Party in the Commonwealth right now?
Well, I mean, I think you might be surprised by this, but I'm actually, this advice is going to be both to Republicans and Democrats, because the reality of what we saw in this last cycle is that Baker's PAC, Political Action Committee, and the Speaker of the House Political Action Committee supported the same people on the Democratic side. So part of what we're also seeing is a centralization of conservative Democrats in leadership in the House with Governor Baker. And what does that mean for both parties as well, right? In terms of, are there opportunities for an unlikely alliance to recalibrate policymaking next in the next session, right? At this point, you know, this session most likely will be what it will be, but coming into the new year and a new two-year session that's going to open up in January, are there unlikely alliances between progressives and Republicans to try to recalibrate what this looks like? Perhaps we can find some common ground on rules reform or transparency, things that actually break apart the debate, because I think part of what the caller was saying and part of what I think Joe was also saying is that part of our problem is that we have this stagnation where we have the same people talking to each other about these issues and we're getting the same result, which is not the advancement that we're looking for. And what we have now is a theater that's so well orchestrated that everybody knows what part to play. But how do we disrupt that theater to be able to reframe the conversation and bring people into this conversation, whether they're voters or people from the Republican or Democratic Party, to figure out how do we get back to the business of policymaking?
So I want to bring a voice in on that, Winnelia. So WBUR also spoke about the parties this week with Tanisha Sullivan, who's the head of the Boston branch of the NAACP. She says the party platform needs to be more focused on real economic issues. Here she is.
Whether single-payer health care should be one of the top three policy positions advanced by the party, I'm not sure. I do think bread and butter is focusing on jobs. We have the jobs here. What we haven't had are policies and programs that have been effective in helping to prepare the residents of the Commonwealth to transition into those jobs.
Which, Joe, implies that the voices of the people who need those policies are not carrying the same weight or the weight that they would need to. So I'll flip the tables on you. What advice would you give to this Commonwealth's Democratic Party to move the ball forward on core issues that have to do with jobs, employment, economic security in this time of crisis?
I mean, I agree. Focusing on jobs is a good idea. It's how Trump got elected in the first place. And Democrats didn't seem to understand that a big push for why he got elected was, you know, him talking about jobs. And I think a lot of the Democrats who won this time around were talking about jobs as well. A lot of the moderate Democrats are talking about that. So I think that's a good strategy. I would, if I was a Democrat, be more talking about along those lines.
All right, now. We try to keep our focus local here, but there is the equivalent of, you know, a slow-moving car crash basically happening in Washington, and it's kind of hard not to watch it. We've got bizarre press conference yesterday from the president's legal team spinning out conspiracy theories that, honestly, even 6 months ago, I think would have been fringe. We've got failing court bids by the president and his administration or his campaign, that's probably more fair, that are prolonging the election here. You got Michigan flip-flopping like a fish on whether to certify the presidential election. Their leading Republicans are meeting with the president of the United States in the White House today, essentially to discuss strategy. Okay, let's stipulate that this is bad for democracy. What I want to ask you is, what do you think the end game is here? Prolong and resign, undermine Biden for a 2024 race for Trump? Is it no strategy? Is it just flailing? Is it Georgia, Georgia, Georgia? You know, Winnelia, what's the end game here?
I mean, you know, I think the end game is Trump fortifying the Republican Party as his party for the next couple of years. And that creating a further fragmentation amongst the national party for the RNC and what that means for them collectively moving forward, right? Because while you have some Republicans that are clear that, you know, you can't build a party with a wing of white supremacy being part of it, right? But then you have some others that are like, well, we can just look the other way, right? But the truth is that he's fortifying that debate for not just Republicans, though, but for the rest of the country. Because let's be honest, at the end of the day, this man is an entertainment magnet, unfortunately. And what that means, I think, you know, for the future is that his messaging and the Trumpism that comes with it is not leaving our national debate anytime soon. And what does that mean for the ability, not just the RNC, but Congress altogether, to be able to effectively try to reset and have a different kind of conversation in this country to move us forward, right? I think that's what really concerns me, that it further splinters our actual democracy in a way that just adds more tribalism at a time when we really need to be looking for our connection points.
Joe, is the strategy going to work?
Well, I think no, ultimately it will fail, but I think the strategy of keeping Trump's hopes alive for 2024, keeping his brand alive, I think is what is going on here. And, you know, but he's going to keep saying that the election was stolen from me, and reinforce that message among his core supporters and take that with him all the way, you know, after Biden takes office. And he will continue to talk about it and make that one of his strong messages. And, you know, I don't know whether that strategy is going to work or not, but, it certainly resonates among his base a lot that hear the same message over and over again. And I do think he's going to be alive for 2024, and it'll be interesting struggle in the Republican Party whether they go back to Trump or not.
All right, so now I want to talk too about the incoming President-elect Biden's administration. News today, there are, you know, some outlets reporting that former Governor Deval Patrick is on Joe Biden's shortlist for Attorney General. We have seen lots of other speculation of Massachusetts names being tossed around. Stephen Lynch, Marty Walsh, Elizabeth Warren, even Charlie Baker. I think one of the interesting questions is the likelihood that a Biden administration would take people who are currently holding elected office in the Commonwealth. Do you see that as likely, Wilnelia?
I mean, it's one of the scenarios, right? And I think that right now, given, you know, it's such a more insular transition process. We don't have the kind of window that we would have into a, you know, what a Biden-Harris transition looks like. You know, I think that we do some folks leave, yes, but I don't think it's going to be a complete domino effect either, right? You know, I think people thinking that all of a sudden it's just going to be a grand departure. I think that there's a lot of meaningful work that you can still do, especially with a Biden administration, by staying in Massachusetts if you're an elected official, whether that's Governor Baker or Mayor Marty Walsh for that matter, right? But I think that they all have different ways to assess this, but I do think that we should expect at least one of these big names to leave Massachusetts. But I think in addition to that, we should also expect the deep talent pool across Massachusetts that may not be elected officials, and what does that also create in terms of, you know, different moving pieces in our government, and, you know, different sectors of our economy here, because we have a very deep talent pool. But I think what's more important, you know, bringing it back to the Commonwealth for one second, is what does that create for opportunities to, you know, for the kinds of people that could be running in those races if that's the case. But I think right now it's the speculation wheel of what that means or not. But the one thing I will say is that Massachusetts needs a reckoning. We've been so focused on what's happening nationally that this is why whenever we pay attention to Beacon Hill, we're like, well, why isn't anything happening over there? It's because there's no harm or foul on what they do. It's a celebration right now, right? Or the same people trying to hold them accountable but not getting a different result, right? So I want to bring that up too, because I do think it's a distraction sometimes, and we need to be able to focus in Massachusetts and use some of these moving pieces as an opportunity to change things.
I am Tiziana Deering, and still with us, Democratic strategist Wilnelia Rivera and Boston Herald political columnist Joe Battenfeld. Joe, I'm going to turn to you. It has been a whiplash of a week on the coronavirus. You got increased dire warnings about the risks associated with people gathering for Thanksgiving, massive case counts, especially nationally, but also good news on the vaccine front. Is this a moment where you're feeling like it's the darkest before the dawn, or it's just dark?
I think I see a dawn ahead. I see the vaccines coming out pretty quickly, and it's going to take a while for them to be distributed, but I think that will give people some hope. But right now, certainly, it is very dark. you know, especially with the Thanksgiving holiday coming up. I see people truly agonizing over what to do about this. They're so used to gathering with relatives at this time, or their parents or their sons or daughters, brothers and sisters, and they just can't, all advice that they're getting is they shouldn't do it. And people are really struggling to deal with this. So I do feel bad that it's going to sort of rip a lot of families apart. But in Massachusetts here, we're not doing well at all. The rate, we have a very high rate of coronavirus in this state, and it seems to have plateaued at about like 2,200 cases a day or something like that. It's not at least going up anymore, but it's certainly very troubling.
Yeah, we've been at above 2,000 cases for 8 of the last 9 days. Well, Nelia, Governor Baker's been very clear, transparent about the fact that he is afraid of Thanksgiving. Here he is speaking to reporters earlier this week about it.
Part of what I'm concerned about here is it's pretty clear that a lot of people are going to travel over the holidays. And there's not much at this point that we can do other than say we think that's not a great idea. And to urge people, if they do that, to recognize and understand that a test is not, you know, a Kevlar vest, okay? It's a moment in time.
So, well, Nelia, we've done 3 call-ins on Radio Boston this week on the coronavirus, especially having to do with the holidays and travel. And we are hearing from people, as Joe said, that they are agonizing over the choices they're being asked to make for the holiday. But we're also hearing people tell us that they are going to make a different choice. So is there a possibility that Thanksgiving, in fact, won't be a super spreader event here in the Commonwealth?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, look, I think right now we obviously have some state guidelines, you know, around curfew, right, in terms of managing, you know, movement of people, right, and this agonizing, you know, reality that all of us are going through. We need leaders that can get ahead of that. You know, I understand that, you know, Governor Baker says that there's not anything more that we can do other than warn people. But the reality is that there is more that he can do, right? We just saw Governor Raimondo make an announcement just recently where they're going to just do Rhode Island. But I said, said Governor Raimondo, yeah, from Rhode Island, excuse me.
Right.
Who just made a tough decision, right, to say that we're going to, you know, shut things down for 2 weeks and that you should only be having Thanksgiving with those that you live with. Look, and it doesn't mean that some people will still not get in their cars and do the right thing. But when leaders at that level of government say, you know what, I'm going to make this tough decision because if it's agonizing for all of you, I'm going to make it for you to make it easier for some of you, to send that message, that public health message, that this actually is the way we should be dealing with the situation, so that maybe hopefully we can have the holidays. But let's also admit to the fact that for a lot of students in the Commonwealth, they haven't really had a real school year, right, in terms of what in-person school looks like. So I think that we really need Governor Baker to really pay attention to what's happening in these next couple of days leading up to Thanksgiving and do that great thinking with his team about whether or not we need to take a step further. And I do think that we do, but we need to take a scalpel at it, right? It's not saying a shutdown exactly like we did in March, but what are the parts of the economy that can be shut down so that we can, you know, get back things in order again?
Let's go to the phones, 800-423-8255. We've got Carolyn on the line from Worcester. Carolyn, go ahead.
Hi, my name's Carolyn, and I just got out of work. I'm a nurse at one of the big hospitals, and I just want to mention the numbers are there, and we're seeing that. I'm seeing personally, because I was in Florida when it first happened at a hospital down there, and it's actually worse, and people are, they know, you know, they've been educated, and it's, you know, the big thing with this holiday, like Thanksgiving, you have to be so careful with elderly patients. That is who we see. We see elderly patients, probably 80% who come in that are very, very contagious. They're the ones that are getting the special treatments. They're on oxygen. They're very delicate. So if I would suggest, even if your relative is healthy, but I'm not going to see my dad. He's 83. I haven't seen him since. I saw him once since March because I work in this business, and I just don't feel comfortable because I would feel horrible if I exposed him.
Carolyn, thank you for the note of caution. Thanks for calling us on your way home from work and for listening, too. We'll be thinking about you. Happy Thanksgiving to you. I'm going to add another voice here, Grady from Arlington. Grady, you go ahead, too.
Hi, yeah. I actually worked for the Contact Tracing Collaborative in Massachusetts over the summer, and we were pretty good at responding to positive tests as they came through because caseloads were rather low. I'm a little bit worried as Thanksgiving approaches, as these cases tend to spike, that that the state will be overburdened. This program, local boards of health, won't have the staffing to make these phone calls to contact trace. And that's going to be a big problem because these phone calls are essential for mitigating the spread of COVID-19 in the state.
Grady, thanks for sharing your experience with us. I appreciate it. Joe, Massachusetts identified its first case of the coronavirus on February 1st. It is November 20th. And we are at a point where we are struggling with testing turnaround fast enough. For some people, if you're asymptomatic, you may not be able to get easy access or free access to a test. We're talking about contact tracing weaknesses there from Grady. Have we failed to scale up sufficiently for this moment?
I think that moment has passed already, unfortunately. I think if we had known about it, how the worst it was going to be earlier, we might have done a better job. But I think there was no way for, you know, to predict just how bad this was going to be and how easily this virus was spread. I mean, there certainly were warnings about it, but you know, it's a tough moment for everybody. There seems to be little that people can do besides act responsibly to combat it. And even people who act responsibly are getting the virus. So, you know, I just, you know, it's going to be interesting to find out, you know, in the coming months what happens, whether that improves or not. But certainly it's not right now. And, you know, I just wish everybody, you know, would take personal responsibility for themselves.
So, Will Nelia, let's turn our attention to the vaccine. A couple of weeks ago, Pfizer says that their vaccine in partial data from their trials was 90% effective. At the beginning of this week, Moderna says theirs is 94.5% effective with partial data. Then Pfizer comes back and says, we've got the rest of the data in. We're at 95%. Mm-hmm. These are high efficacy rates. Are you feeling hopeful about an effective vaccine on the horizon that's going to actually get us to being a vaccinated population sometime in 2021?
I mean, I'm hopeful, but I don't think that as a whole population we'll be able to get vaccinated. I don't think we just don't have the supply chains to do that unless, you know, something major and drastic happens to be able to do that. But I think that we have to have measured expectations around who are the classes of people that need to get it first. You know, I think of our healthcare frontline workers, you know, and other folks that are working directly with vulnerable populations that are constantly in risk, right? And I also think about our, you know, people that work in our school buildings and our students that need to get back to school again as well, right? So I do think that the tiering of who gets the vaccine first and why, I think it's going to be very, very important to keep a really close eye on that, and particularly how that then impacts the way the drug itself gets distributed across the country. So I do think that, you know, part of what the vaccine is also going to demonstrate is that, you know, the kind of infrastructure that we also need to be able to distribute the vaccine and have people also live in a different kind of way in places that they need to, because this is going to shift how we're living as a country. We need to be able to also get ahead of that in terms of what that also looks like, because it's not just going to be as simple as administering a vaccine to everyone, and it's going to be a couple of years, right? And I think that we need to be more honest. You know, we need leaders in our country and our Commonwealth that can have a real honest conversation about why it's going to take this long, but how we're going to use it as an opportunity not just to vaccinate ourselves, but to really also do the kind of like real rebuilding that this country needs to have more opportunities for those that often have been denied it.
So, Joe, you just heard Will Nelia say that, you know, we don't have the pipelines, the capacity that we need to. And you were saying we underestimated what this fall was going to look like and we weren't prepared for as bad as it was. But we need to be ready for a vaccine. And, yeah. And Massachusetts, I mean, we're the healthcare mecca here in the Commonwealth. Moderna is here. Is there something that the Commonwealth can be doing to both get itself better ready, but help demonstrate to the country how to get this vaccine produced and out there?
I mean, some of it is just public relations, getting the message out there that this vaccine is safe and that you really need to take it. Convincing people to take it is one big part of the strategy. And just, you know, the infrastructure is another big part of the strategy. It's making sure that there aren't, you know, huge lines when the vaccine does come out, that people are actually able to get it. I don't know, you know, what that strategy would be, but, you know, the state certainly needs to be, all states need to be preparing for this. And I think we can do it. I think actually I'm a little hopeful that we can do it, that it, I don't think it'll take a couple years to get people vaccinated. I think it'll be quicker than that. Nobody ever thought this vaccine would come out this soon. You know, it's a heroic effort by people working at Moderna and Pfizer and other places to get these vaccines out. So, you know, I see a little hope there.
All right. I do want to leave a little time now before we close for our hubbubs. Those are those brief stories or events that caught our attention this week. Well, Nelia, did you bring us a short hubbub?
I did. And in the spirit of everything that we're talking about COVID and, you know, what does it mean to have a more distanced, you know, Thanksgiving at a time when most of us are, you know, we'll be getting ready to see our loved ones. You know, Zoom actually lifted its 40-minute time limit that they have for free calls. You know, not everybody's necessarily, you know, working through a Zoom like some of us are, but for those family members that can't arrive, you know, they can actually use Zoom, you know, for that 24-hour period of all of Thanksgiving Day. You know, it's not the same as hugging your grandma, you know, or kissing your nephews, you know, and playing some, you know, some games, you know, over the weekend. But I think it's more of what we need to be doing to show how we care for each other. So that's my hubbub for the week.
I like that one. Thank you. That's heartening. How about you, Joe? What's your hubbub this week?
I was somewhat heartening. One, I wanted to wish Joe Biden a happy birthday. Yeah. Today's his 78th birthday. He will be America's oldest president when he takes office. And it'll be interesting to see the challenges that he faces because of his age. You know, hopefully, you know, it doesn't set him back. But I just wish him the best.
All right. So happy birthday to President-elect Joe Biden as well. All right. So folks know that I am an animal person. And I discovered this week, I was this today years old when I found out that pygmy hippos are a thing. And their babies, which are called calves, are absolutely adorable. And according to MassLive.com, so the Franklin Park Zoo had their first successful birth of one of this endangered species, the pygmy hippo. They have this baby, they've got pictures, it's adorable, and they're auctioning off the ability to name him. The auction opened yesterday. It's a silent auction. It closes on November 29th. The money goes to the Franklin Park Zoo and the Stone Zoo. Mostly, I just want you to look at the pictures. I will say, my choice would be Herbert, having seen him, but we'll have to wait and see what the name is for the pygmy hippo calf in the end. Very sweet. All right, that is our show. Will Nelia Rivera, Democratic strategist and founder and head of Rivera Consulting. Joe Battenfeld, political columnist at the Boston Herald. Thanks so much for joining me, and happy Thanksgiving to both of you.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Thank you. Have a great one.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. Have a good weekend. And join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.